Hello and a very happy new year to you all. Welcome to the first Film Weekly of 2009 with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show, we go from hot to cold, from Mumbai to the Arctic to the Oscars and beyond.
I thought it was just the kind of indulgent kind of fantasy that you have about every film you make. You know, we all feel that. You think, this is the one, when you say those on it. There are a number of people who've said this has got Oscar written all over it, you know, and I just went...
Danny Boyle there will be hearing from the man of the moment as his film Slumdog Millionaire finally hits the UK's screens and starts that Oscar momentum. From the sweltering skies of Mumbai to the creaking icebergs of the North Pole.
Mother Nature just decided to do whatever she wanted. I mean, she is the star of the movie. Yeah. My God, and
it
what a
beautiful.
Diva she is. She's stunning.
I'll be talking to Michelle Yeoh about her compelling performance in Asif Kapadia's Far North. And Zan Brooks is back after a cinema detox. Zan and I will be reviewing Slumdog Millionaire. We'll watch Daniel Craig go Yiddish in defiance while we go all laddish to review Role Models starring Sean William Scott and Paul Rudd. Warming your ears on these dark, chill winter days, it's Film Weekly. After the sci-fi film Sunshine, British director Danny Boyle must have known that his destiny was to move towards the heat and hysteria of India. And his latest film, Slumdog Millionaire, is a film all about destiny and has these things in abundance as we enter the slums of Mumbai to unearth a fantastical tale. The film traces the fate of Jamal, played by Skins star Dev Patel. Jamal is on the cusp of manhood and one answer away from winning or losing 20 million rupees on India's version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Who invented the revolver?
Samuel Colt.
Final answer.
Final answer.
Jamal Malik. You're on a dream run. My heart says you're gonna win more. Computer ji, ye lock kiya jaye. I was right. The Chaiwala has done it again.
Slumdog Millionaire has been winning audiences and awards around the world, and ahead of its UK release, I met up with Danny in our new studios here at The Guardian to find out how much destiny played a part in realising his film.
It's been very strange. You don't think it to begin with, obviously, but it's been very strange working in India, where it's, as a nation, they believe in the concept of destiny as one of the movers of life, and they believe in it in a very profound and serious way. And they saw many parallels going on, which I became slowly aware of. And certainly some of the things that's happened to the journey that the film's made, both in the when we shot it there and subsequently, its journey subsequently, has made me a bit more respectful of what they believed in. And the smile they give me now when I see them, I was there just before Christmas, the smile they give me, which is a knowing smile about what they told me about would happen to the film, the destiny that they could see for the film, I thought it was just a kind of indulgent kind of fantasy that you have about every film you make. You know, we all feel that. You think, this is the one, when you say those on it. But actually, the smile comes from a confidence that I don't quite know where that confidence comes from, but it's secure. And it's a kind of meaningful confidence.
So what
as well.
Did what did they predict? Was there one sage's advice that you remember?
There were a number of people who said this has got Oscar written all over it, you know. And I just went, oh. I mean, when you make a film like The Beach, you kind of think, oh, maybe, yeah. You know, this is the one or something like that, because you're clearly setting out to be in that territory. You're using a major star and you're using a kind of accessible material, an idea.
Very popular source novel as well.
Popular source novel. But this was not that. Was no way it was ever that. And I just thought, I remember feeling very cynical about, I didn't say it back to them really, but I thought, they know nothing, is basically. Now they look at me and say, think, you knew nothing. We knew everything. Because not that we have got any Oscar nominations, nor may we not, but it, certainly to be in that world we're in at the moment, is something that they always thought the film was destined for, yes.
What do you think it is about Slumdog Millionaire that has appealed so widely? I mean, obviously, it's a beautifully made film. I love watching it. I love the energy. I love the feel of it. But there's something about the narrative, isn't there? Or is it the kind of ubiquity of the success of the quiz show of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire that everyone recognises?
The quiz show obviously helps us, and it will help us. It's opened in America, Australia and Italy. And it will help us in many, many different territories because of the familiarity of the show and the ability that the individual distributor can use the show's hook to sell the film to people who might not normally notice the film or want to go to see it. No, but I don't think it's that. I think it's actually, and I've thought about this a lot because of its success in America. I thought, what is it about? Because I never thought it would work in America. Mm. I thought it'll work in Britain because of our relationship with India, our visible Indian population. And someone like Dev Patel in London, for instance, is recognisable and from Skins.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that'll help sell the film. I think it's, but none of those apply in America, which is about as far away from India as you can get. I think it's the universality of the story. It's the underdog against all the odds succeeding. And not for success's sake or money's sake or fame's sake, a la the game show. It's like Rocky. It's for love, eventually. And I think that story, particularly for America, has to be retold constantly, dressed up differently, but actually set in different places, but retold like that. It's a universality about that, I think.
Yeah, is that a universality that you see in most of your movies or in the movie business as well? Is that the core of the narrative pulse of most successful movies?
I think it must be in some way. I've got to be honest, I didn't even realise I was making that kind of film until people start to watch it, because your concentration in a film is on different things. You're not, you think you'd be on the whole picture, but you're not actually. You're on so much detail within it that you don't really realise that until it starts to play. And you realise people get caught up in the story of the underdog and they are rooting for him in the way that expression means. They root for him. And you can hear them gasp in the audience as he gets questions right, or it's all going wrong. Oh no, you know. You can feel them emote like this and you forget that. I mean, I must have felt that the first time I read it, because that's the closest you ever are to how the audience experienced the film. But that's a long time ago, and a lot of water and technical things have gone under the bridge
and
since then.
And I assume when you're shooting in somewhere like Mumbai, that all storyboarding goes out the window, that, as you said, that bigger picture, like, where am I going? I mean, you literally, presumably, have to get shots done where you can, when the weather, when the crowd.
Yeah, you do, actually. And you also, I've never, ever done this before. You'd finish sequences and you'd think secretly, you wouldn't reveal it to anyone because it'll just cause mass panic. You think, I'm not sure we got that and we're never coming back here. But you go with it because it's the only way you can work there, really. You cannot kind of stamp control on the place and actually make it fit your will. You have to fit yourself to it. And that meant that there'd be certain things you'd think, I'd no idea whether we've got that. But I remember when we started editing the film thinking, that's way better than anything I could have even imagined with storyboards. You know, so the benefit comes to you because you've trusted it. Mm-hmm. And they believe, just going back to that whole destiny thing, they believe that as well. It's part of that idea of trusting where you are and who you're with. And there are things you don't understand which will benefit you at some point.
Well, it does sound that there's a divinity somewhere that shapes our end. But maybe in a way that the work that you did with the Film Weekly guest this week, Michelle Yeoh, on Sunshine, was about, I mean, they're very different movies, but they are about reaching for the stars, if you like, reaching for this kind of this kind of forbidden place. And, you know, Sunshine is about space. It is about kind of what might be written in the stars.
And against all the odds and the unattainable. And can you touch the unattainable?
Yeah.
Can you get there?
Can you reach out? I mean, that film was... It might not have been one of your most successful films, but it had all of the kind of longing in it and beauty. Yeah. And I must say, there were sort of jaw-dropping moments in that film.
I know,
film.
Some of it. I saw some of it. I saw it over my daughter's shoulder a few weeks ago. She was watching it with
her
mate.
Are you embarrassed like that? Don't watch
it. I was watching it, about, you know, the way you watch from the kitchen over their shoulder. Yeah. I watched about 40 minutes of it. I thought, well, that's quite good, that.
Who made this?
But she's an extraordinary person
Michelle
to work
Yeoh.
With. Yes, mm-hmm. Very special. Obviously is in a world where she could choose to be, she's in a very rarefied world. She's an international movie star and lives in a very sophisticated and extraordinary world. But she remains a very humble and fascinating person who was prepared to abandon that lifestyle to help us make this film.
Yeah, didn't you put them all in student accommodation in Hackney or something?
Yeah, no, in Mile End. They live by the canal in Mile End. And they were all chipped in together in common digs. And they'd all cook for each other of an evening and they'd all sit around singing songs and stuff like that. She embraced that really in a way. I found her very wise. And I also found her one of those people who you don't appreciate how fine her acting is until you see it in the editing room. There's certain actors who you are very impressive in the room when you're shooting, and sometimes you get it back to the editing room and it doesn't work quite as well. There are other actors, she's one of them, where in the room you're not quite sure what she's doing. You get it back in the editing room and you think, oh, there it is. It's extraordinary. And it sounds funny saying it, but it was kind of like big. It's one of the little peaks of my career, personally, on a personal level, having worked with her, actually, yeah.
Right, well, I mean, I think she was equally complimentary about working with you, it has to be said. And just let me say, before you go off, and because you're off to Golden Globes this weekend, aren't you?
Yes, we are, actually. That's a very nice way of putting it, but it is true, actually, yeah.
It's not something you get to say to someone when they ask you at the Globes. I guess it's a very Hollywood thing to say, but it's not a very kind of, North London thing to say. See you at the Globes. Have you done all that before? Have you been through this red carpet process? I know we were at the closing night of the London Film Festival, but the Golden Globes, I mean, you're going to be rubbing, you're going to have to get a tan, a back wax, if you're going to rub shoulders with Angelina Jolie.
I've never been to the Golden Globes, which I hear is great fun because they all sit around tables, whereas the Oscars. I went to the Oscars once. John Hodge, who adapted Trainspotting, got a nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay. So we visited the Oscars.
But he took you as his date.
No, he took his good wife, Lucy. And the rest of us sat at the back. And it really is sitting at the back. And you realise quite quickly you're not going to win anything here because you're at the back, waving at the back of the auditorium, which I suspect is where we'll be. If we get there with Slumdog, I suspect we'll always be waving.
Right at the front next to Jack Nicholson, and you know it. We wish you the best of luck with it, Dan.
Thanks very much, Jason.
And Slumdog Millionaire is on UK-wide release from Friday the 9th of January. Danny Boyle will also be featuring in my In the Director's Chair series of interviews, an in-depth look at his long career, from Trainspotting to The Beach to Sunshine and beyond up to Slumdog Millionaire. You can watch them online by going to guardian.co.uk/in-the-directors-chair. Joining me now to run down the first reviews of 2009 in this week's releases is Guardian film critic Zan Brooks. Welcome back, Zan. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
Did you have a good one?
I had a very good one. It's quite a quiet one, but, right back, ready to go now.
Do you take time off from watching films? Because, I've just spent 2 weeks and I hardly saw a film at all, and I feel refreshed now and ready to get my teeth into
it. I guess so. I kind of had a weird New Year's Eve, which part of it was spent watching Benjamin Button, so that felt like a bit of a busman's holiday for me. But it was pleasant enough.
Yeah, it's a good film, Benjamin Button. Mm. More of which later. I like it very much. Let's start off this week's reviews. We're going to do Slumdog Millionaire, then we're going to go on to Role Models, then we're going to go into Defiance. So let's start with Slumdog Millionaire, a film which needs no setting up. We've just had Danny Boyle talking about the film. It closed the London Film Festival with its premiere here in the UK, and it's finally out this week. It's a film that I feel has been around for ages. I wonder if it can kind of stand up to the level of hype that's attendant on it now.
I think it probably can, and I think that the fact that it's a drama set in India, set in Mumbai, means that it probably needs the hype to kind of attract people who would normally be kind of turned off seeing such a film. It's not your kind of the obvious setting for a big, colourful blockbuster, which is really what this is.
It's interesting you say that, because it has got this big heart and it's a big blockbuster and it takes people on this big kind of uplifting journey, but it does start in the mud.
It starts in the mud. It starts very much in the mud, in the sort of what we're expected to believe is the sort of the harsh reality of life in the slums of Mumbai. And it has a very kind of Dickensian take on this. It has a lot of kind of snap and colour, and it looks fantastic. But it is a rags-to-riches tale, so it moves from there to a very different setting, probably exposing how India is. I mean, it's a land, that old travel cliche, a land of contrasts. And it is a place where great wealth goes kind of cheek by jowl with great poverty.
And that comes across in the movie as well. I mean, I love the opening sequence, which is kind of reminded me of City of God in a way. And I'm sure that there's a sort of deliberate quote there, which that film took us into the favelas of Rio from the chicken's eye view. And this film takes us into the slums of Mumbai from an urchin's eye view.
Yes, indeed. It's certainly going for the City of God vibe here. But
it's a good vibe to go for.
It's a very good vibe to go for, but it then does different things. And I think the success or failure of this film, and I have to say that I liked it a huge amount, depends on which way you come at it from, because it's really trying a thing where it's marrying kind of harsh social realism with the kind of colourful fairy tale of Bollywood cinema. And I actually think that if you come at it as a sort of Bollywood fairy tale, it's great and it's superb and it sweeps you along. If you try and see this as a kind of warts and all study of the real India, it suddenly starts feeling a little suspect.
Yeah, it's not Satyajit Ray, is it?
It's certainly not going for Satyajit Ray. I think technically it's superb. It's filmed by Anthony Dodd Mantle, who's a cinematographer of great renown, and he really kind of brings it out in all its kind of gaudy, colourful beauty. I think it does have a heart, and I think that it does win people over, and it is a story that we kind of perhaps crave for. It has a sort of a kind of mythic arc to it in a way, and particularly in these sort of credit crunch times, it's something that we can kind of fix on.
Yeah, we all want to get rich quick, don't we? So that's Slumdog Millionaire, and we wish Danny Boyle the best of luck with it as well. I kind of support him like a British athlete off to the Olympics.
Absolutely, yeah.
Let's move on, Zan, to Role Models, a rather different fish of a film, starring that lovely man Paul Rudd and that normally not so nice man Sean William Scott. Here they're given community service and they have to look after two latchkey kids, taking them to a restaurant.
So, do you like Coca-Cola?
I like the idea of it more than I actually like it. Ooh, they got chicken fingers. I'm gonna run a train on these chicken fingers. I'm just gonna be like, yum, 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 yum.
Let me guess, you're not really rolling with the ladies in school, are you, Augie?
Oh, no, I'm really good friends with the school nurse. She's a divorcee.
So, Augie, it's a pretty interesting cape.
Are you like a superhero or something?
I wish. No, this is part of my battle attire for Lair.
What the hell is Lair?
It's this fantasy world where anything is possible. One minute you could be sparring with an elf, and the next you could be battling against a troll who wants nothing more than just to steal your gold and leave you penniless.
Sounds gay.
No, there's girls there.
Girls can be gay.
If by gay you mean the old English definition of fun, enjoyable, and carefree, then yes, it's extremely gay.
Zan, an unlikely couple, Sean William Scott and Paul Rudd, together at last.
But it kind of works, doesn't it? I mean, Paul Rudd is the sort of the pensive, anxious, uptight slacker, and Sean William Scott is the sort of the boorish frat boy slacker,
isn't he?
So they're the kind of the Bob and Bing of the slacker comedy
in
genre.
This road to redemption, yeah, the strange road to redemption.
And the weird thing about this film is the influence of Judd Apatow is so prevalent these days that you're kind of almost tempted to kind of stick his brand on any film that has these sort of American boy men in various states of disrepair in it. And this isn't a Judd Apatow comedy, but it kind of is in a weird way. And like a Judd Apatow comedy, it's fitfully very funny.
Yes, it is. That's the thing. I mean, ultimately, you know, it is a kind of sort of, boorish, boyish comedy as well. But I laughed quite a lot.
I laughed a lot. And also, I mean, I think maybe on Film Weekly we should occasionally kind of celebrate the supporting actors a bit more. And this has a great supporting turn from an actor I didn't really know about called Jane Lynch, who plays the sort of the demagogic recovering addict who runs this mentoring program with her kind of terrible buzz phrases and combative attitude. And she's a purely kind of brilliant comic creation.
Yeah, I think she's part of that Christopher Guest ensemble. I've seen her in For Your Consideration.
Yes, I think you're right,
like
yeah.
That. And I'm sure she's kind of big on American TV in some way, but I've never really seen her given such a free rein. She's always talking about don't BS a BSer, and her mixed metaphors are kind of, Mrs. Malaprop is the kind of the lodestone for such things. And I think she should be the new one because she has a new phrase. I think that, you know, the only thing you can judge a comedy like this is, you know, does it offend you or does it make you laugh? And this one, I sniggered a lot, including the great little racist kind of little black boy who kind of kept calling Paul Rudd Ben Affleck.
Yeah. And he says, if you're white, you're Ben Affleck. and obviously the kind of key joke of this film is that the mentors are more wayward, irresponsible, mixed up than the kids that they're looking after. And it's a bit of a one-note joke. And yet I kind of laughed fairly consistently, maybe sort of 5-10 minute intervals all the way through.
Yeah, I did too. Oh, guilty pleasure, Role Models, mark it down, the first of 2009. Let's move into the woods, Zant, for Defiant, a film that stars Daniel Craig, Jamie Bell and Liev Schreiber as Jewish resistant fighters, the Bilski brothers, holding up in the woods in Lithuania to hold off the Germans and their local collaborators during the 1940s.
But there are a few things you must learn about living here. When you are arrested and settled, you will be assigned work duties. Everyone will work. There are no exceptions. We will help supply our Russian partisan comrades. We will mend clothes. We will repair weapons. Women will learn to shoot, and they will fight alongside men. Pregnancies are forbidden. We cannot accommodate an infant's needs here. Today, we will start rebuilding the lives you have all lost. This is the one place in all of Belarusia where a Jew can be free.
Zan, bellicose Jews are not the flavour of the month at the moment in the world media. How does this film have a strange note then for you?
Well, there's a great scene where the Daniel Craig character is brought up before a Russian colonel who kind of looks at him contemptuously and says, but Jews don't fight. And he says, these Jews do, as if we needed any reminding at this particular moment of history. But at the same time, you can see why the Bielski brothers are so appealing for Hollywood filmmakers, because they do offer an antidote to a lot of Holocaust movies in which you know, the Jews are basically these soulful, passive victims who are kind of led away to their fate and they're depending on the kindness of a sort of passing good German like Oskar Schindler or something. These Jews do fight back. They are kind of, you know, you've got James Bond playing the lead fighter here.
James Bernstein.
And there's a slight kind of element of Rambo to it in the way they all kind of hole up in the woods and use natural resources and kind of steal guns and fight back.
Yeah, I thought it was a bit odd that Daniel Craig was cast as this kind of, you know, the tough Jew, if you like. But then, of course, I remember thinking back to Munich, Steven Spielberg's kind of take on... He's got form. I think he's the go-to... Jews go to Daniel Craig and say, I know you're blonde, but can we just borrow you for a while to kind of be an example of strength?
Yeah, they could have had, you know, Schwarzenegger as the second brother and Stallone as the third.
It's like he's 007, but for you, I'll do it for 003 and a half.
Yeah. There you go.
I've been working on that. The film, though, directed by Ed Zwick, who's a kind of an interesting director, because he did About Last Night, and then he did Glory with Denzel Washington.
Yeah, and he did Blood Diamond.
He kind of works on a big canvas.
He's a workmanlike director who works on a big canvas, and maybe he has the sort of liberal stroke, slightly conservative credentials. It's kind of, you know, Hollywood liberalism here. And I guess Defiance is in the same mould as Glory, which was about the African-American regiment who fought in the Civil War, which is basically saying, you know, the blacks actually did something in the Civil War to end slavery as well. And this is kind of following a similar kind of course.
Yeah, it's kind of
really.
Sort of, you know, I don't know, Form 3 kind of level of history, isn't it? But for Defiance, I actually, as a Jew watching it, as you say, it was a change from those kind of, oh, look at my passive ancestors led out of the ghetto, all helpless. Here they are tearing off their stars to bust out of the ghetto and go live in the woods, kind of, and I thought the complexity of intellect versus action was very well handled.
It was handled well, and there's a sort of sense that these are the kind of the brawny rural Jews who are typically looked down with on suspicion by the kind of the intellectual urban Jews, and it does make a play of that. There's also a very good scene in which a German soldier is brought into the camp, and he's terrified, and suddenly you know your audience empathy kind of switches, and you're kind of fearing for him, and he's surrounded by all these kind of middle-aged and aging people who basically just attack him. And that's just very well done and kind of dropped in there, and it's totally understandable and believable.
Yeah, well, I think tap into Defiance there with Daniel Craig, Jamie Bell and Liev Schreiber. A huge film weekly thanks to Zan Brooks as ever. Lovely to have you back with us, Zan, for all your latest musings on film reviews and news. Go to guardian.co.uk/film. Talking of Daniel Craig in Defiance there, we've got another loose link to the Bond brand, because it was 1997's Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies that introduced the Chinese actress Michelle Yeoh to international audiences. After this stint as a Bond girl, one of my favourites, I have to say, Yeoh has never looked back, jumping literally and metaphorically between Asian and Western cinema with a deftness of style all her own. The Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon star's latest role is as the central character in British director Asif Kapadia's feature, Far North. Michelle plays a nomadic Arctic deer herder who, along with her companion Anja, has just come upon an injured soldier Loki, played by Sean Bean. From that point on, Danger and Desire conspire to put these people's lives at risk. I met up with Michelle to find out about this innovative and striking film, but first, let's hear a clip of the wind and snow in Far North.
We're leaving. I want a family. I want my children to grow up with others. To have everything I didn't. You know nothing about him. Who he is, what he's done.
He told me everything.
I know it will not be easy there. But I have to take this chance. There has to be more than this.
Michelle Yeoh, thank you so much for joining us on Film Weekly. You're here to celebrate the release of your film Far North that you've made with Asif Kapadia, a quite stunning film that I've talked about on the show before when I saw it in Venice first. It's taken a little while to come out here in the UK, but I'm delighted that it is. What an experience it must have been to make this film in extreme conditions.
I thought it was such a privilege to be able to be part of it because, you know, it took me to a place that I never thought that I would get to and stay for such a long time.
This is the Arctic Circle, the Far North.
It literally is. We were at the furthest up north city, you know, Longyearbyen. And then we went on an icebreaker to the glaciers. And we were, for the first time in my life, I think in a very long while, I actually stayed in one place, which was on a boat. So that, you know, we couldn't make the trip from the town to, you know, the glacier would have taken too much time. And then, you know, jump on these little zodiacs and, you know, get on the fjord. And when we were there, it was not frozen over yet, and there was still light. And we had a very short window to film. We literally had to be in and out of that place within a few weeks.
Otherwise, the ice would melt or freeze over to too cold.
The problem was, you never knew what the weather would be like tomorrow. And in fact, one of the things that we agreed upon was, like, we knew the script so well that there was no exact schedule. Because tomorrow you open, you know, I would look out my little pothole and it would be all snow. And the day before, there was nothing at all. So we just changed. Mother Nature just decided to do whatever she wanted. And, I mean, she is the star of the movie. Yes. My God, and
it
what
is
a
beautiful.
Diva she is. She's stunning. I mean, that place is just absolutely fantastic. I remember I had a camera. I always had a camera in my pocket. But it was so cold that I would stick, you know, take a few pictures and then put it back in because it was just so cold.
How do you act in those conditions? How do you keep your mind on what you have to do?
But that is the part of the emotion, because your face is frozen. You know, everything, that's why people don't talk very much there. And everything is very intimate inside the tent. And when you're outside, how the chills, that cold, it makes you feel from the gut. And that's when you see all these kind of things happening.
I think you're a very interesting actress, Michelle, particularly because you tend to be involved in films where action speaks louder than words. You know, I mean, one thinks of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, but again, you had to kind of endure quite extreme filming there as well, I suppose.
Right. For Crouching Tiger, one of the most extreme was because I actually had knee surgery right at the beginning of the movie. I had an injury after the running around on the rooftop.
Yeah, that looked dangerous.
Well, knee surgery, boom, straight to Baltimore, Johns Hopkins, and then 3 weeks later came back onto the set. Yes, it was traumatic. But fortunately, it was such an amazing film to be part of. And actually, you know, funny you should mention that film, because I always told Asif that he reminded me very much of Ang Lee.
I bet he quite liked that.
I hope it's definitely a compliment, because, you know, it's relatively easy to be a director. But it's very, very hard to be a really good director. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of sensitivity, that dedication. You can't have anything else going on in your life. Your movie has to overwhelm you, you know, just take you over. As an actor, I love directors like that.
Is that what you look for when you make your choices?
Of course, when they send you the script, then you look at the script and you think, okay, this is interesting. But words are dead. You know, it's only on paper. It's the director with a vision that has something to say, but from his guts, from his heart, that really makes a difference.
Because had you seen his first film, The Warrior, which has a beautiful, beautiful landscapes too?
I think that was one of the things that attracted. First, you know, because you've not met him. Then I do research in what they've done before, you know, how they present certain things. And when I saw The Warrior, I saw a really terrible DVD, which did no justice, you know, to the camera work. But I love the way he told his story.
How do you... I mean, you're obviously clearly a very instinctual, natural person, Michelle, and a natural actress, and I know you've dance training, but you're quite a spiritual actress as well. How do you manage to keep that and go for roles like that, but also appear in films like The Mummy and Babylon AD, big effects-laden films? How do you manage to keep a kind of sense of reality of what's going on when you're in... Or, you know, when you have a quite mad life?
Yeah, but it's a very blessed life. You know, as an actor, you're able to walk into so many different kind of lives, so many different from all walks of life. You know, within that year, I was an astronaut in Sunshine. You know, then I was a reindeer herder in Far North, and then next thing I was like this a wizard in Mummy 3 and a nun in Babylon AD. I mean, it's just the sound of it, but it gives me real pleasure. It's because it's such a great learning experience. Because, you know, when I was with the Samis, they are the indigenous reindeer herders up in Norway and Finland and all those kind of things. The way they are, it's just a purity of the simplicity of movements. You know, it's like, yeah, it's there. Okay, you whip it out and you do it. I mean, it was just so fascinating. So you sit there and you think, I'm such a contemporary, I'm a, you know, 21st century gal. You know, what the heck am I doing up there? And then when you're there, but that is the adventure. That is the beauty about what we do.
Well, Michelle Yeoh, thank you so much for sharing that with us. The energy that you've brought to the film role in Far North is terrific. The stillness plus the energy. And thank you for sharing that energy with us on Film Weekly. I wish you as interesting a 2009 as 2008 was for you too.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Far North is already on UK-wide release, and it's well worth seeking out on the big screen because Asif Kapadia's vision is truly cinematic and just won't transfer the same way to DVD. So, that's all we've got time for on this first edition of Film Weekly for 2009. My thanks to Michelle Yeoh and to all my other guests this week, to the great Danny Boyle and to Zan Brooks, of course. Do pick up an Observer this Sunday to catch my Trailer Trash column, and why not join me on Facebook? Film Weekly Fans is our group, but for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.